When I saw the building, I thought the TV didn't do justice to the damage.
FBI agent Danny Coulson is being interviewed here by the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum. Agent Coulson remembers feeling overwhelmed watching firefighters running into the collapsing Murrah building.
And everybody wanting to help, and civilians helping people out. We're Americans, that's the way we respond to bad things. We pull together and we deal with things. And that was my first impression. My second impression was, we're gonna find these guys. I mean, there's no doubt, as much as I knew I'd wake up the next morning, we're gonna arrest these guys.
If you remember, it was Coulson who picked up Timothy McVeigh from the Noble County Courthouse and then transferred him to federal custody on a helicopter. Soon after that, Coulson interviewed McVeigh's father, Bill.
And I asked him, who are his best friends? And he said, Terry Nichols, Michael Fortier. I said, would they have done this? He said, if anybody would have, they would have.
This is a recorded prison call of Terry Nichols, just days after his arrest. He's talking to his mother, Joyce.
I want you to be very honest, Terry. If you made a mistake, admit it. Cooperation is much better and much smoother. Because this is big, serious trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yes, a lot of people died out there.
Yeah.
And I can't believe that you're part of that.
Neither can I.
Well, if you are...
I can't believe I'm, here. Because, I know Tim.
Michael Fortier had watched news reports about the FBI search of the Nichols family farm in Michigan, and he was terrified. On Monday, April 24th, 1995... Danny Coulson and his fellow agents arrived at Michael and Lori Fortier's mobile home in Kingman, Arizona. As agents searched their home, the yellow Gadsden flag, Don't Tread on Me, which served as the unofficial banner of the militia movement, was flying over the Fortier's trailer. But at the time, the agents didn't find enough evidence to arrest Fortier. Still, Coulson wanted to convey the stakes of the case. So he sent word to the local sheriff's department to bring in Fortier for a conversation.
And they brought him in, and he's kind of a scruffy-looking, not an impressive guy at all. I understand why he washed out of the military. They wouldn't want him. So we started talking. I said, we need to talk to you about the bombing.
Fortier tried talking politics with Coulson.
And he said to me, you don't understand, we're at war. I said, no, we're not. If we were at war, I would have killed McVeigh, and I would have killed you. Because I have the capability. I said, you may be at war with your country. Your country is not at war with you. And he said, well, it's about the Constitution. I said, oh, you're right. It is about the Constitution. And we're going to investigate you under the Constitution. And we're going to indict you under the Constitution. And then we're going to convict you under the Constitution. And we'll handle your appeal under the Constitution. And one day we're going to strap you to a gurney. And we're going to stick a needle in your arm. We're going to kill you under the Constitution. And he became very upset. When a middle-aged man whispers to you, he's going to kill you, and he knows you can do it, I think that's scary. And that's what I wanted to do.
Coulson advised Fortier to go get a lawyer and get some decent advice. Then he could decide whether to get on his side or McVeigh's side, life or death. Fortier went back and forth about what to do. He and his wife, Lori, both had detailed knowledge of McVeigh's plan. Michael had gone with McVeigh to case the Murrah building, and Lori had watched McVeigh demonstrate the design of the bomb using soup cans from her pantry. But days later, Coulson's threat still hadn't done the job, at least not yet.
I do not believe that Tim blew up any building in Oklahoma.
CNN landed an exclusive interview with Fortier.
There's nothing for me to look back upon and say, oh yeah, that might have been, I should have seen it back then. There was nothing like that.
That was a complete lie. Michael Fortier eventually did get legal advice, and he did decide to flip.
They talked it over, and guess what? He showed up and testified in trial, as did his wife.
Prosecutors agreed to grant immunity to Lori, In exchange for the Fortier's testimony and Michael pleading guilty to a series of charges, his prison sentence would be greatly reduced.
He was a very important witness. He told the story. I mean, this is what we did, this is where we did it, this is when we did it. And that was a big part of the case, I think. But it shows that we are a nation of laws and that the Constitution matters to me. And it's going to keep you alive. And if you don't cooperate, it's going to kill you.
I'm Jeffrey Toobin, and this is Homegrown. Episode 7, United States versus Timothy McVeigh. The stakes for the trial of Timothy McVeigh were enormous, and the media scrutiny was intense. It was the largest number of murders ever prosecuted in a single trial. For his part, McVeigh didn't seem too bothered about the prospect of a conviction. His problem was the government. The whole point of his actions on April 19, 1995, was to damage the federal government, and he didn't want to see his enemy vindicated in the courtroom.
If they're subjecting me to the mail seizure, I'm sure they're subjecting Terry too, so just be on guard. They read it when it comes in, but they haven't been completely seizing it. Now they're just taking it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So,
it's more psychological warfare.
Exactly.
In August of 1995, about 4 months after his arrest, McVeigh was being held in a federal prison in El Reno, Oklahoma. He called James Nichols, Terry's brother, to gripe about the feds confiscating his mail. For someone facing trial for killing 168 people, McVeigh sounded calm, and his disdain for the government was obvious.
It's still fucked, you know?
Well, yeah, but I mean, they'll take their time up, too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, add another person to the payroll, right?
Well, spend their money.
Well, before we get ourselves in trouble, I'd better get off my social phone call, you know?
James then asked McVeigh how he's doing and what he thought of his lawyer, Stephen Jones.
What do you think of Jones?
I like him.
Yeah.
He's doing a good job. I understand you were in the office. I got the report that you had been...
Yeah, we spent about 3 hours with him, and I feel a lot better, but... I told him right up front I didn't trust him.
Well, like anybody else, I'm never comfortable unless I can do it myself either. But
right.
Unfortunately, in this case, I need a couple hands, you know?
Right. I know what you mean.
In that phone call, McVeigh did have a good word to say about Jones, but the good feelings between the two didn't last. McVeigh was, to put it simply, an impossible client. For starters, of course, he was guilty. Totally guilty. He bombed the Murrah Building. What was more, he was proud that he bombed the Murrah Building. He wanted the whole world to know what he did and why. But at the same time, McVeigh did want a defense at trial and preferably an acquittal. It was all contradictory and kind of nuts, and Jones had to figure out how to do his job. It wasn't easy.
He thought he was the captain of the ship. And so, therefore, all decisions had to be made by him.
You mean in his defense?
Yeah,
in his courtroom defense.
Right.
He thought he was in charge.
Right. He thought he was in charge. Chairman of the board, that's the way I put it. And I said, well, you are, in terms of whether you plead guilty or not, whether you testify or not, and I will always consult with you. But you're not the chairman of the board. You're the client.
So, how did Stephen Jones find himself representing one of the most infamous domestic terrorists in American history? Well, Jones' background was a bit unusual. For much of his life, he wanted to be a politician. Jones grew up near Houston, but he moved to Enid, Oklahoma, a city where he had no previous ties, because he thought the area offered him the best chance to run for office. And Jones did run, over and over. But in 1990, his political career ended in a U.S. Senate race, where Jones got just 17% of the vote. In his law practice, J. Jones represented the notorious 1960s radical Abbie Hoffman, who wasn't popular in Oklahoma, and he built a reputation for dogged fearlessness. Jones tried cases all over Oklahoma for a variety of clients: Republican politicians, oil and gas interests, the occasional death row case, and Jones often won. By the mid-90s, he was making about $1 million a year, but Jones never got the attention that would have come with political success. Then, on the night of May 5, 1995, Jones got a call from a federal judge in Oklahoma City.
And I think he began by telling me, well, you know why I'm calling. And I said, Your Honor, I have no idea why you're calling me. And he said, well, then I'll come straight to the point. He said, would you agree to represent someone who has been or will be charged with the Oklahoma City bombing?
Jones took some time to think about it. After talking through the risks with his family, he called the judge back.
And I said, Your Honor, the answer is yes.
Jones asked the judge, why him?
He said, well, your professionalism and ethics and so forth. And I said, well, that describes probably 200 or 300 other lawyers in Oklahoma City area. I said, what's the real reason? And he said, well, the real reason is you're big enough to take the hit. And I thought, that's probably right.
In their initial meetings, Jones said McVeigh seemed cooperative, but he immediately sensed something unusual about his client.
Most people who are suspects in a crime or charged with a crime are very hesitant to tell their lawyer the full story early on. I mean, that McVeigh was the exception to that. I mean, it was almost before I could say, well, tell me what happened, he was telling me what happened. I was skeptical because that was contrary to my experience.
Beyond his initial skepticism about McVeigh's story, Jones saw his client's attitude as a public relations problem.
My concern with Tim was that Tim, as I perceived it, Tim wanted to take credit.
Jones told another member of the defense team that he was concerned that McVeigh was going to destroy their ability to put on a defense before they even started.
I said, you know what scares the hell out of me? He said, what's that? And I said, getting a telephone, because the media was calling me all the time. I said, Secretary Karen's going to tell me someday that Mike Wallace is on the line, and I'm going to pick up the phone, and he's going to say, Stephen, this is Mike Wallace, CBS 60 Minutes. Listen, we just finished a 45-minute conversation with your client, Tim McVeigh, who called us, and we want to ask you about it. I said, he's got telephone privileges. He can do that anytime. And that will kill us. So we have to find a way to control that.
Jones laid out a plan. He would gladly handle the press and try to shape coverage to his client's advantage. But in the meantime, Jones promised that a lawyer would visit McVeigh every single day in prison. This resulted in constant, indulgent meetings where McVeigh would pontificate about what he thought his defense strategy should be. The problem was that McVeigh never really made up his mind about how he should be defended.
Tim always had, Jeff, contradictory goals.
In one meeting with his lawyers, McVeigh spelled out his goals for the trial. Number one, that the truth of the bombing come out. Number two, that he be acquitted. Number three, that he embarrassed the government. Number four, that after all the evidence is heard, the case remain a mystery.
And I told him, I said, well, Tim, these are inconsistent. I mean, you cannot make it a mystery and at the same time not answer the government's evidence. And he understood all that on an intellectual level. But on an emotional level, he rejected it.
So what was McVeigh's defense going to be? How about insanity? To explore that option, Jones hired a psychiatrist to evaluate his client. A report concluded that McVeigh was, quote, extremely self-centered and narcissistic, but there was no evidence for an insanity defense. How about a defense based around family dysfunction? McVeigh hated that one, and he forbade his lawyers from blaming his family for his own decisions. Stephen Jones had a different idea. He saw an opening in the government's own case against his client. Those three words that Merrick Garland had let slip into the indictment. with others unknown. According to Jones, those words meant that even the federal government believed that there was a broader conspiracy behind the bombing.
I thought, well, the government, they haven't really, this not tight. So let's argue reasonable doubt. And McVeigh was enthusiastic. He supported it until we started talking about others. And that's when the road got a little bumpy.
This became the root of the tension between McVeigh and Jones. Others.
Every time we would talk to him about others, he viewed as a degrading of his own role. That was absolutely offensive to him. And he was the mastermind who planned it all.
McVeigh always said that he did it alone, or with a little help from just Nichols. Jones didn't buy it.
You claim it's only you. You're saying, well, there may be a lot of smoke, Stephen, but there's no fire. And I'm telling you, the reason there's no fire is you're pouring water on it, and that may be creating the smoke that I'm seeing.
To this day, Jones is convinced that there was a broader conspiracy. He's never really spelled out what the conspiracy is and who was in on it. It's mostly just insinuation. But this was the theory that Jones wanted to present to the jury, that the real guilty parties were still out there.
We're not saying to you that Tim McVeigh is not involved. What we're saying to you is there are others.
Jones wanted a definitive account of McVeigh's side of the story, to see if he could find any evidence that his client was actually covering for others unknown. So in the late summer of 1995, after he had investigated the case for several months, Jones hired a court reporter to conduct a private transcribed interview with McVeigh. I know this because Jones donated the transcript along with 635 boxes containing his full file on the McVeigh case to the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas. As a lawyer, I have reservations about what Jones did, but as a journalist, I dove in. The material gave me an incredible insight into McVeigh's mind.
I, Timothy James McVeigh, of lawful age, having been first duly sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, state as follows.
Jones began the interview by administering an oath, but since this was a private deposition, the oath didn't mean anything. It was just legal theater to impress on McVeigh the seriousness of the interview. Over 2 days, in 8 hours of questioning, McVeigh told his life story.
I was a member of the NRA, and I think I was a registered Republican at the time, so I was active in voting. That would have probably been when I was 16. To get a hunting license, you need to be a member of the NRA in that county, and also a member of the gun club.
Jones put a special emphasis on McVeigh's planning for the bombing.
The charge is on the driver's side of the indented portion. That way, wherever it's initiated, it's like a slow burn. Picture an explosion as a slow burn.
McVeigh gave an amazing performance. He was comprehensive, detailed, and consistent about the story he had told from the beginning.
So the initiator charge and the booster charge of the main charge were on the driver's side, in between the high-yield barrels and the ANFO. Right in between, in the back of the truck.
But Stephen Jones still wasn't buying. He still believed that McVeigh was covering for others. McVeigh said he'd take a lie detector test. Deal, said Jones. Were you born in Lockport, New York?
Yes.
Are you 27 years old?
Yes.
Do you plan to try to lie to me on this test?
No.
Other than the people discussed, was there anyone else involved with you in the planning of the bombing?
No.
Is your last name McVeigh?
Yes.
Other than Terry Nichols, was there anyone else involved with you in the execution of that bombing?
No.
Were you born in the year 1968?
Yes.
Are you attempting to keep any information from me regarding the involvement of another individual?
No.
He flunked the part about whether he was there alone.
The polygraph examiner said there was, quote, absolutely no doubt in my mind, unquote, that McVeigh was protecting someone's identity. McVeigh scoffed and said that his lawyers were going to have fun for the next year because they would be wasting their time looking for co-conspirators. The breach between McVeigh and Jones was widening.
Before we sat down to speak in your beautiful home here in Enid, I noticed that on one of the fireplaces there was an inscription about, you can, I'm going to paraphrase, but you can judge a society by how it treats its most reviled members.
Treats its worst citizens.
Worst citizens.
I think that's Goethe that said that. My wife gave that to me after I came home from Denver. That was a gift that she gave me, and so it's on the mantelpiece. If you agree to represent someone, you have a duty to provide an aggressive defense. And that's what all lawyers do. They should do. That's what we're required to do.
From the beginning, as the McVeigh case, with its incredibly high stakes, was making its way through the court system, there was one legally complicated question. Where was this trial going to take place? The federal courthouse in downtown Oklahoma City was just a block from the Murrah Building, and it was damaged in the bombing. Judges and court personnel were offered counseling for their trauma. The city, even the whole state, was convulsed with grief and anger. A jury pool here was beyond tainted. The defense filed a motion for a change of venue. Prosecutors disagreed. Finally, an appeals court gave the defense a tremendous victory. The trial was moved to Denver. Enter a veteran federal judge named Richard Mache. Mache looked like a lawman from the Old West, with his droopy mustache, lean frame, and cowboy boots under his robe. He wanted things done quickly, fairly, and his way. Mache loved the law. People, less so.
Judge Mache could have been kinder, I thought. I thought he was unduly critical and harsh, particularly to some of the younger lawyers.
Lead prosecutor Joseph Hartzler, here interviewed by the Oklahoma City Memorial.
I mean, we were all professional. We were just trying to do our job. There's no reason for him to be so demeaning and condescending.
We were all a bit afraid of him.
Another member of the prosecution team, Beth Wilkinson.
Judge Mache was always very strict with everyone and went out of his way, as he should, to make sure the defendant got a fair trial.
As with the prosecutors, Judge Mache's behavior was shaped by the O.J. Simpson trial. Even in ordinary circumstances, Mache presided with surly impatience. But the post-O.J. hangover gave the judge a deep desire to wield total control over his courtroom. Mache was fixated on guaranteeing that McVeigh received a fair trial. The judge wanted no emotional outbursts, and he provided stern warnings to the prosecutors over how much heartrending testimony from victims he would allow. Meanwhile, on the defense, Stephen Jones was building a small army.
I believed everyone deserved a vigorous defense. And I've tried to do that, and I think to the large part succeeded.
In October 1996, a few months before the trial was set to begin, Jones arranged for a group photo of McVeigh's defense team. There are 25 people in the photo, and that's not counting two of the lawyers who were absent on that day.
He clearly needed a defense, and it clearly had to be wholehearted. It couldn't be with one arm tied behind your back.
In the months before the trial, Jones' wholehearted defense became a really expensive defense. In normal circumstances, the Justice Department and the courts impose some limits on overall defense expenses. But Merrick Garland decided from the beginning that he would allow the defense to have effectively an unlimited budget. Garland didn't want to risk a claim, perhaps years in the future, that McVeigh didn't have adequate resources to defend himself. Judge Mache agreed, and Jones took full advantage. Ultimately, McVeigh's defense cost the taxpayers about $20 million. On the government's dime, Jones traveled all over the world trying to establish some sort of international conspiracy behind the bombing. Jones and his team went to China, the Philippines, Macau, Hong Kong, Germany, the United Kingdom, Syria, Jordan, Israel, South Korea, and Washington, D.C. These trips produced more speculation than evidence.
In my opinion,
here's Jones talking to the Associated Press.
Based upon everything that I know, the bombing was the work of somewhere between 6 and 8 people directly involved, and probably others that may have assisted indirectly, or if they assisted directly, didn't really know what they were contributing to. But at the core, I think you have to say there's 6 or 8.
Jones' theories broke down roughly into 2 strands, and they've shaped the way the Oklahoma City bombing has long been perceived. For the right, Jones played up McVeigh's supposed connections to Muslim fundamentalists in the Philippines via Terry Nichols' numerous trips to visit his mail-order bride there. For the left, Jones suggested a broad right-wing plot that extended to white supremacists in Arkansas and Oklahoma. There is some evidence that McVeigh had contact with these groups, but nothing to suggest they had any role in the bombing. McVeigh watched all this and stewed. The whole premise of Jones' journeys was that his client was lying to him about the bombing.
I mean, it was chaotic at the end. And McVeigh was very unhappy with his legal team.
Defense attorney Gerilyn Merritt saw firsthand how bitter everything became.
There were points at which the lawyers in Stephen's office were instructed not to take a call from him for a period of time. McVeigh would also call individual lawyers and say, well, when it comes time for my appeal, I want you and this lawyer, but I'm getting rid of everybody else. So it was a lot of manipulation. You just really ended up not believing what anybody said and just going about your business, which was defending him.
As the trial neared, McVeigh's defense descended into the realm of black comedy. It started with a discovery by then Dallas Morning News journalist Pete Slover.
So at some point, the Dallas Morning News obtained a pile of defense-related documents in what's typically known as a leak.
On Friday, February 28, 1997, just a month before jury selection was scheduled to begin, Slover put in a call to Stephen Jones.
I said, Pete, how are you? Fine. Then I said, what can I do for you? And he said, kind of, as I recall, kind of talking fast. He said, well, we're writing this story. We're running with it that McVeigh confessed to you that he was the actual bomber. He was guilty.
At this point, of course, there was nothing public about McVeigh's private confession to his lawyers.
We found that there was a confession from McVeigh.
Jones feigned ignorance, told Slover someone was pulling his leg. Slover said, nope, this is legit. I have a document.
Without disclosing any sources, I can tell you that the records that were obtained that showed a McVeigh confession satisfied the Morning News editors and lawyers that the confession was real. And he said that he wanted a high body count and that he knew there were children in a daycare in the building he was blowing up.
And Pete said something that indicated to me that maybe the document was from our files. He used an expression, and I thought, I've read that before.
Pete Slover never told me the source of the leak, but I managed to find out who it was on my own. It turns out that one of Jones' private investigators was having misgivings about working on McVeigh's defense. The PI knew that McVeigh was guilty, but what if he was acquitted? How could this man live with himself if he participated in such an injustice? The investigator handed Pete Slover his laptop, which contained thousands of defense documents. The timing couldn't have been worse.
I said, but Pete, the jury summons have gone out. Trial starts, what, in 6 weeks? And if you're running such a story on defense document, then you've got it some illegal way unless you've got a consent signed by me or McVeigh. There's no one else authorized to give you any documents. So you didn't acquire it legally.
Jones reacted by saying that these documents were fake. Then he said the documents were stolen. Then he said they were fake and stolen.
And I'm going to go tell Judge Mach. I'm going to inform him what you're doing.
Jones told Slover that he was going to ask Judge Mach to issue a prior restraint, which would stop the Morning News from publishing the story.
Now, we would probably prevail eventually, but we wanted to get the story in the paper.
In response, the newspaper decided to do something that had never been done before. Just 5 months earlier, the Morning News had unveiled its first site on what was then called the World Wide Web, and the paper posted Slover's story online before it ran in print the next day. By the time Jones went to Mach, the story was already out, and there was nothing that either of them could do about it.
At the time in the newsroom, you had TVs up, you know, like old-fashioned, not flat-screen TVs, each playing all the major networks. So you'd see soap operas and game shows. Well, one by one, every network broke in with news. The Dallas Morning News has reported a McVeigh confession. And it was a big old story.
Jones railed against the paper to the media.
They put it on the internet because they thought we were going to come over here and try to get a temporary injunction from them, and they wanted to once again slap Judge Mach and his orders across the face and preempt him. Now, this is about the most irresponsible form of journalism. In addition to that, they betrayed...
So, I knew then that we were going to lose the trial.
Jones asked Mach to delay the trial. The judge refused and ordered jury selection to begin as scheduled on March 31st, 1997.
What do we do? I said, well, we wait for them to make a mistake. Because there are mistakes, and we have to let them make one. And they will make one. And that will be our salvation, and if it's not, then we have the appeal. That is all we can do, is to go forward with what we have. But we're here, the trial's set, we have to show up. We have to do the best we can.
And going into the trial, what was your defense? What was the defense?
It hadn't been proven beyond reasonable doubt.
Jones tried hard to find the supposed others unknown behind the bombing. He conducted countless interviews with McVeigh. He chased every rumor. He took all those trips around the world. But on the eve of the trial, all that Jones had was a traditional defense. The government hadn't proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
We have much to be thankful for. With 4 years of growth, we have won back the basic strength of our economy.
Timothy McVeigh's trial took place at a remarkably calm moment in American history.
We are winning back our optimism, the enduring faith that we can master any difficulty.
When Bill Clinton delivered his State of the Union address on February 4, 1997, he was able to boast, with justification, about unrivaled peace and prosperity all across the world.
My fellow Americans, the state of our union is strong.
In the absence of national crises, sensational crimes filled the news hole.
One is why, yes.
At the very moment that Clinton began his remarks, a civil jury in Santa Monica found O.J. Simpson liable for murder.
O.J. Simpson is responsible for the death of Ronald Goldman.
Neighbors described the young girl as beautiful and polite.
There was the macabre fascination with the murder of JonBenet Ramsey.
Deputy coroners brought the body of 6-year-old JonBenet Ramsey from her upscale home.
Our fear of them is irrational.
There were shark attacks.
Now, we investigate the truth behind shark attacks, separating fact from fiction.
Collectively, America was on vacation, and the news media provided the beach reads. That, by and large, was how most journalists, including me, covered McVeigh's trial in Denver, as a crime story rather than a political story. For journalists, the saga of Oklahoma City had shrunk in the 2 years between the bombing and McVeigh's trial. The story that began as a symptom of a hidden but growing menace in the American heartland ended as a narrow inquiry into the actions of one man. America was thriving, so how could McVeigh be anything except a regrettable oddity in this moment of national serenity?
Well, good morning. We're going to open the record in this proceeding with regard to application 95-501 for a groundwater permit. My name's Lou Claver.
The government's first witness was Cynthia Claver, the lawyer at the Oklahoma Water Resources Board. Claver described how April 19, 1995 began, and the tape of that morning's proceeding was played for the jury.
Receive information regarding him.
The vastness of the crime scene was unprecedented. It was kind of a 2 mile square radius. No one in the United States had ever seen anything like that.
Beth Wilkinson, one of the lead prosecutors at the McVeigh trial.
And so we wanted to show how powerful and devastating the bomb was, and so how evil the conspirators were, and how much devastation they actually caused in the community.
To begin, lead prosecutor Joseph Hartzler focused on the victims, especially the children. But the prosecution had to strike a delicate balance. Judge Mache explicitly stated that he wouldn't allow too much victim testimony in the trial. So, interspersed with the other evidence, the government lawyers selectively put victims on the stand.
I would cry sometimes at preparing them, and the judge was very clear. He didn't want any crying. And I remember everybody, and not just on the prosecution team, but on the media, as you know, there were many people that had a tough time sitting there and looking down. The stories were just so painful, and it was certainly the most difficult thing I've ever done in a courtroom.
There would be prosecutors crying during that testimony, which I thought was completely inappropriate.
McVeigh defense attorney Geralyn Merritt.
I thought it was unfair because the jury is not supposed to be swayed by emotion. They're only supposed to be swayed by facts and the law as the judge instructs them. And we mentioned it to the judge. They shouldn't be crying during the testimony. They're prosecutors.
Everybody was crying and emotional, but out of it, I come great admiration for the victims and the survivors.
I was bothered.
Lead defense attorney Stephen Jones.
I think the government did a brilliant job to highlight victim and survivor testimony at strategic moments in the trial. So emotionally, they prepared the jury to cry with them. I've tried a lot of cases. I know when it's going well for the other side.
Since there were no witnesses who actually saw McVeigh set off the bomb, the government presented a circumstantial case, but a compelling one. The proof of motive, McVeigh's hatred of Clinton's federal government, was abundant. McVeigh's behavior was beyond just suspicious. The government showed how McVeigh and Nichols assembled the ingredients for the bomb and how McVeigh rented the Ryder truck. But the witnesses who tied the whole thing together were the Fortiers. Lori Fortier was put on the stand first. She described McVeigh and her soup cans.
That was pretty credible. Had a ring of truth when she described him as taking the cans out of the cupboard and setting them on the floor in the very shape that he planned to create the bomb.
Then lead prosecutor Joseph Hartzler brought Michael Fortier up to testify.
When you put the whole thing together, you realize you had all these various circumstantial pieces that were very strong on their own. I think we could have proven the case without Michael Fortier. But for Michael Fortier to have gone by the building with McVeigh and have McVeigh point out saying, that's the building and I intend to bomb, that was pretty strong evidence.
To counter all this, Stephen Jones did his best to poke holes in the government's case. He emphasized how no one saw McVeigh at the Murrah building, how the ID at the body shop wasn't a good one. Jones raised the mystery of John Doe number 2. He criticized the FBI's forensics. He attacked the Fortiers as unreliable because of their deals with the government. But what Jones did not deliver was a theory of the case that explained how someone other than his client bombed the Murrah building.
What was the defense? Didn't really have anything that was cohesive in terms of putting it all together to point to an alternative person that did any of this.
So you're really kind of throwing things against the wall and hoping something sticks.
Defense attorney Gerilyn Merritt.
It was like just challenging, trying to create reasonable doubt. On the other hand, you had to be very careful not to come out and say Timothy McVeigh is innocent.
I didn't have any doubt. I mean, I didn't have any doubt from practically the first day when we heard the opening statement. There wasn't much there in terms. And I'm not faulting Stephen Jones. I mean, he just didn't have much to work with.
Right.
McVeigh and Jones sat next to each other throughout the trial, but the poisonous relationship between them was very evident. They exchanged few words. During the over 5 weeks of testimony, McVeigh did his best not to react. The victim's family members in the courtroom seethed at his stone-faced expression in response to even the most heartrending testimony. But McVeigh told his lawyers that he wanted to maintain military discipline.
I do remember sitting in the courtroom and watching him be so stern the entire time and never show any emotion. And I certainly didn't think that was a good tactic, but more importantly, I didn't know how he could do that.
Prosecutor Beth Wilkinson.
I don't know how he could have sat there to watch all these victims, survivors, police officers, people, other victims, and he just never showed any emotion. So it was difficult to understand a guy who was not mentally impaired, who could do that and then sit through that entire process and apparently not feel anything.
After 28 days of testimony, the jury began deliberating on the morning of Friday, May 30th. Judge Mache ordered them to continue working over the weekend. The panel took 23 hours over 4 days and had no questions for the judge. On Monday, June 2nd, just after lunch, the jurors returned their verdict. I was there. Normally, the moment when a verdict is read is one of extraordinary tension. I've been in plenty of courtrooms where the air is heavy over what the fate of the defendant will be. But even with the enormous stakes of this case, the announcement was curiously lacking in drama. There could be only one outcome of this trial. The verdict didn't surprise the lawyers on either side. But what they didn't expect was how many people were waiting to hear it outside. Lead prosecutor Joseph Hartzler.
It was unbelievable on the streets. And around the courthouse, I didn't have any idea that a crowd had gathered like that.
Guilty on all 11 counts. The jury finds Tim McVeigh guilty on all 11 counts. There are people applauding here in downtown Denver across the street.
Guilty on all.
Guilty on every count.
Corrected all 11.
You can hear Oklahoma City applauding.
And then to hear the uproarious applause when we came out was a pretty heady experience. Probably the only time in my life I'll ever have that.
Ultimately, Terry Nichols would be found guilty for his part in conspiring to bomb the Murrah Building. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Nichols is still there today. After his plea bargain, Michael Fortier was sentenced to 12 years in prison. He was released in 2006. Michael, his wife Lori, and their two children are now in the Federal Witness Protection Program. In McVeigh's case, after the guilty verdict, the trial moved quickly to the penalty phase, where the jury would determine whether McVeigh would be sentenced to life in prison or execution.
I tend to see Tim McVeigh a little differently than most people.
Stephen Jones put several dozen character witnesses on the stand.
A number of them were fellow soldiers.
Right.
They were obviously sincere, and the fact that they were in the military, some of them were still in uniform, helped us. Friends, neighbors, people that he'd babysit, his mother, father, sister.
And what was the gist of what they all said?
Shock. This was not the Tim McVeigh they knew. He was a good citizen. He was a good military, fought for his country. We felt safe with him. Those types of things. It was more emotional than logical. And I think it gave the jury at least some pause overnight.
You just said earlier you see Tim McVeigh differently than most people. What did you mean by that?
He was an ordinary person whose critical judgments failed. I could not find any evidence that he was in any way mentally disturbed. His cognitive faculties were all there. His reasons were there. He convinced himself, or was convinced, that the government had committed a terrible wrong. He tried to intellectualize it, but it was emotional. And he acted on that. Some of my friends have said, well, Tim McVeigh would have been at the Capitol on January 6th. And I said, well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure he would have been there.
Stephen Jones is a good lawyer, but I do disagree with him about that last point. I think McVeigh would have been at the Capitol on January 6th. In fact, I think he was.
Hey, we see a cycle repeating itself, harkening back to what we saw in the early 90s, which led up to the Oklahoma City bombing.
Next time on Homegrown, the ashes.
They put his remains in a plastic box, gave them to me. I remember they were still warm at the time.
Homegrown Oklahoma City is a USG audio podcast produced by Western Sound in association with Esmail Corp. It's reported, written, and hosted by me, Jeffrey Toobin. Executive producers are Josh Block at USG Audio, Sam Esmail and Chad Hamilton at Esmail Corp., and Western Sound's Ben Adair and Colin McNulty, who is also the editor. Production support from Josh Laulongi at USG Audio. The producer and sound designer is Tyler Hill. The associate producer is Stella Hardman. The producer from Esmail Corp. is Sarah Maddy. Original theme and engineering by Alex McGinnis. Fact-checking by Nicole McNulty and Savannah Wright. Special thanks to Betsy Shepard and Dan Leone. Passages of Timothy McVeigh are read by Chris Cowan. Our gratitude also to the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum and the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas. For more information on this podcast and other podcasts by USG Audio, go to our website, usgaudio.com. And to learn even more, read my book, Homegrown: Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism.